editors of Time, the weekly news magazine, raise the curtain again on their new kind of reporting of the news. The reenacting of memorable scenes from the news of the week, from the March of Time. Washington, D.C.
You and I have known from the beginning that the time would come when I would have to go. That time has now come. I said it would be red fire in the beginning and dead cats and oblivion in the end.
Thus, in a Washington auditorium this week, General Hugh S. Johnson says farewell to 2,000 of his fellow workers in the NRA. And over the radio, the nation listens in to the valedictory of the man who, in a short 15-month public career, has made himself one of the most colorful characters in recent U.S. history. The man who, for 15 months, was the NRA. For 15 months, the warrior for the Blue Eagle. Exhorting, flattering, cursing, praise-making from the beginning of his public career.
We're going to do this job in a goldfish bowl.
And suppose some industries refuse to go along with the coast, General?
We'll crack right down on them.
They say you're not cooperating, General. They say you're coercing.
The charge of compulsion is nothing but the invention of big generals.
Retailers are planning to profiteer under cover of the Blue Eagle, General.
Say, if anybody tries to trifle with that bird, he'll get a spot right on the nose.
The press has published the news that your secretary, Francis Robinson, gets $5,780 a year, General.
That was one below the belt. She knows more about this organization than anyone else. I'm sure that nobody here ever thought she was a mere stenographer or secretary. She's been my personal assistant straight through.
General Johnson to critics of the NRA.
Away, slight men. You may have been leaders once. You are corporals of disaster now. And it is not safe to stand obstructing the front of this great army. You might be trampled underfoot. Not knowingly, but inadvertently because of your small stature and of the uplifted glance of a people whose eyes have seen the glory.
General Johnson on the Republican social program.
All they did was to go into a purple silence and produce a kippered herring in a dark can. You know, a kippered herring is one that smells and has no, inside.
General Johnson on President Roosevelt.
I want to tell you that if there is such a thing as national luck, Uncle Sam was carrying a hat full of rabbit's feet when the country elected Franklin Roosevelt to the president.
As loyal to the president as to the NRA, not the least of General Hugh Johnson's services was acting as buffer for anti-administration criticism. As for his work, justice of opinions is, he made the best of a bad job. His monument, code, signed, sealed, delivered. His most praised accomplishment, extirpation of child labor, establishment of the minimum wage as a national principle, and the strengthening of collective bargaining in his industry. These things he did, almost single-handed, for them and for himself. The nation cries a hail and farewell as his last speech closes.
We can stand on that record, you and I. It is an accomplishment of which all the worthies could be proud. There remains only to say goodbye. And this, in my present state of emotion and affection, I cannot do. And now that it is time to go, all I can say is, God bless you.
Time marches on.
Balmoral Castle, Scotland. In the private parlor of Queen Mary of England at her Scottish Balmoral Castle this week, gay, lightsome Princess Marina of Greece, Prince George's new fiancé, is attempting to do the Highland Fling. Tall, regal Queen Mary is instructing and demonstrating, while from a gramophone comes the skirl of Scottish bagpipe.
There now, Marina, dear. A little hop on the left foot. Hook, kneel to knee. That's just it. Now point the right toe. Hook, splendid. Splendid.
But it is so complicated.
You learn very quickly, Marina. Now right and cross over.
Oh, I'm sorry. That was wrong.
Yes.
If only I didn't have to leave the dance at the ball.
Oh, but you must, you know. Oh, dear, listen to me. Talking like a mother-in-law already. What I meant was, you can't help but like it.
Oh, I do. But it's just I'm not used to it.
You're really doing very well, my dear.
Do you hold this Gillies ball every year, or just when there's a new princess?
Every year. It's an old Scottish tradition here at Balmoral. We give it for the servants. Everyone from the youngest page to the oldest housemaid and gamekeeper will come.
But tomorrow night, I'm really afraid I shan't learn in time.
Oh, I'm sure you'll do it beautifully. I had to learn the fling, too, 40 years ago. Our Scottish subject expected of every British princess.
Oh, I'll do my best. I'm ready to try again now.
Very well. Annie, the same record again.
Yes, Your Majesty. It's all ready.
Now, from the beginning. And don't forget to cry hoop with each fifth.
Oh, dear.
Now, hand to hip, heel to knee. Oh, hip. Splendid. Now, point and around. Oh, and again. Oh, Marina, I'm predicting that you'll be the most popular princess who ever danced the fling at Gillies.
Oh. And on the following night, skipping, hopping, prancing, curveting down the length of the great hall of Balmoral Castle, the great Princess Marina, clad in tartan, kilts and sporran, leads the highland fling of the Gillies ball to the skirl of the royal bagpipes, and before the proud and encouraging eyes of her fiancé, Prince George, of their Majesties King George V, and Queen Mary, and of 270 grinning, cheering Scottish servants of Balmoral.
1934 marches on.
From Ernst Hans Stangl, 1909 Harvard graduate, and now Adolf Hitler's publicity agent-in-chief, goes a letter to James Bryant Conant, president of Harvard University.
Dear President Conant, it is my profound conviction that my years at Harvard have given me incalculable advantages. I have decided, therefore, to offer the sum of $1,000 to be known as the Dr. Hans Stangl Scholarship, to enable an outstanding Harvard student to spend 1 year in Germany. 6 months to be spent in Germany's art center, my native city of Munich, the remainder in any other German university. This, to my mind, fittingly symbolizes my perennial love and affection for Harvard, Boston, and New England. Sincerely yours, Ernst Hans Stangl.
Back to Berlin to Nazi Hans Stangl. This week goes a reply from President Conant.
Dear Dr. Hans Stangl, although the Harvard Corporation appreciates your generosity as a Harvard alumnus, they have voted to decline your gift. We are unwilling to accept a gift from one who has been so closely associated with the leader of a political party which has inflicted damage on the universities of Germany through measures which have struck at principles we believe to be fundamental to universities throughout the world. Very truly yours, James B. Conant.
Time marches on. This week, dogging the public's unhappy memory of the notorious Stavisky scandal with its trail of disgraced officials, swindles, murders, suicide, and the bloody overthrow of the cabinet, comes disturbing news. In an office of the police station at Lille, two officers of the Paris police confront each other. They are Chief Inspector Fressard and one of his inspectors, Paul Mariani. A guard stands by the door.
Paul Mariani, you have been an inspector of police for a number of years. A respected, honored member of the police force.
Thank you, Inspector.
We have always had perfect faith in you.
I hope I have been worthy of that trust.
Through the past unhappy year, the names of many in the Department of Police have been blackened by politics and the Stavisky scandal. But through it all, Mariani, I have the utmost confidence in your integrity.
You honor me, sir.
You have betrayed that confidence, Mariani.
What do you mean?
You have betrayed more than our confidence, Mariani. You have betrayed the honor of the police of France.
Well, I don't understand.
You deny that you've been using your position to protect criminals, to make yourself head of a nefarious graft ring.
Why, certainly I deny it.
Deny that while a trusted police inspector, you've been operating a gang which forges automobile licenses, smuggles narcotics, extorts money from householders, traffics in white slavery.
Inspector, this is a pack of lies.
Within 48 hours, we shall have witnesses. From Paris, Lyon, Nice, everywhere you have operated your gang.
I tell you, this is ridiculous.
God, take this man. Take him.
You are making a grave mistake. Inspector, I warn you, I have friends.
Next day, as investigation of Mariani proceeds and evidence piles up, six more of the Mariani ring are arrested. The French press and people proclaim Mariani a second Stavisky. With more revelations and more arrests, speak darkly of possible bloodshed. Then, mysteriously, a letter is found in the Lille police station. No one saw it delivered. It reads,
Inspector Fasson, if you and those assisting you do not drop the charges against Paul Mariani at once, there will be a violent death. Perhaps several deaths. Perhaps yours.
On the morning of the following day, while police officials ignore the death threats and continue the investigation, Ford Lille speed witnesses call for the Mariani case. At this moment, the Riviera Express nears Paris. A porter goes through the corridors, awakening passengers.
Half an hour to Paris. Last call for Paris. Hello, Pierre. What is it?
You remember the passenger in compartment 5?
The little Italian. The one who was talking about that Paris inspector who's just been arrested.
Porter.
Yes, monsieur?
What time is it?
9:30, monsieur.
Yes. The Italian in 5 said to be sure to call him. But he's not there. His bed hasn't been slept in.
Did you look on the platform?
I've looked everywhere.
He was with a friend. They were the ones who hopped on at Nice at the last minute.
Jacques, there's something funny about them. The way they hid behind the baggage rack and then dashed for the train after it started.
Yeah, they both look like criminals, all right. Oh, but it's none of our affair, Pierre.
Porter,
they're coming, monsieur.
Wait a moment, Jacques. There's this business of the death threats. And both of them whispering about Mariani. And now the one in 5 disappears.
Maybe it's with his friend here in 12. Monsieur...
He doesn't answer either.
Monsieur!
Jacques, I tell you something's wrong.
Monsieur!
You see? Force the door.
Pierre, look. They're dead.
Both of them shot through the brain.
Investigation reveals that the dead men are René Beltlemin and Jean Alibert, wanted for questioning in the Mariani case. As in the Stavisky trial, in which a major witness was murdered before he could testify, the two criminals die mysteriously before the police can question them. Meanwhile, with further exposés of higher officials expected, the French government is suddenly face to face with a new scandal which rivals the Stavisky crisis. Remembering the bloody riots of an aroused Paris last February, France's President Dumas goes to his people by radio this week to plead for new confidence in his government and to warn that violent civil strife is the only alternative. Time marches on. The United States. This week, number one old dealer Herbert Hoover and the cabinet's most radical new dealer, Secretary of Agriculture Henry A. Wallace, go before the country with magazines for megaphones in the sharpest conflict of political philosophy since 1932. Hoover with his challenge to liberty in the Saturday Evening Post, Wallace with his tyranny of greed in Collier. On NRA codes, old dealer Hoover.
Today in the United States, the old philosophy of individual liberty is under attack. Spurred the old process of code making has been to impose the codes by means of the threat of depriving our citizens of their business and their livelihood.
New dealer Wallace.
When the codes were fixed up under NRA, businessmen came to Washington by the thousands, anxious, eager to make codes. In fact, many of them hoped through these codes to put their competitors out of business.
On regimentation of business.
Over all small businesses in every town and village, every day in the week, is now the daily dictation by government of how men are to conduct their daily lives.
By the use of our new rules over business, it is possible to direct, stimulate, restrain, and balance our economy so we do proportion the national income for the greatest good to the greatest number.
On Old Deal versus New Deal.
At Lexington, at Valley Forge, at every step on the western frontier are the graves of Americans who died that the human spirit might go free.
The pioneer path of the American people came to an abrupt end in 1914. The old order is played out. A new one, with new rules, must be arranged. And if the rules are not changed fast enough and in the right direction, the American game will break up in a riot.
Time marches on. Curramore Park, County Waterford, Ireland, 200 years ago in the reign of George II.
Bless your chaining, woman. It's never a way to bring back the dead.
My lord, tis you hung my lad in the garret. Tis you left my young lad's body swinging in the wind.
Well, just cause, woman. It yourself knows that I was acting for the crown, that the young spalpeen was spoiled for his fate with many a black deed to his name.
No blacker than yours, my lord, with breaking of a mother's heart and putting out the spark of your life.
Be silent, old woman. The law is the law.
If it's quiet, I'll be with my young lad hanging there cold and dead.
Up with your room. The lad is dead for good reason.
I'll not be off.
Be gone, I say, before I use my whip.
You'll use no whip on me, my lord. I curse your lord, Belford, for the murder of my son. I curse you in the house of Waterford. Unto the seventh generation, I curse each lord of Waterford. Your son, and your son's son, and that son's son. Every man child born under your roof.
So, in the 18th century, is the most dread of ancient Ireland's curses put on the House of Waterford. As the years of two centuries roll by, those skeptics who laugh at superstition fall gradually silent. At the turn of the 19th century, Henry, 3rd Marquess of Waterford, dies of a broken neck in a hunting accident. Two generations later, John, 5th Marquess, blows out his brain. As the years of the curse roll on, Lord de la Poor Beresford is trampled to death by a runaway horse. Lord Marquess Beresford is found mysteriously dead in his bed. Lord de Laval Beresford is killed in an American train wreck. As the 20th century begins, Charles, 6th Marquess of Waterford, fearful of the doom of his forebears, arranges that his son John Charles is born in London, not under the Waterford roof tree. 11 years later, the elder Charles slips and drowns in a stream on his ancestral estate, and young John Charles becomes the 7th Marquess of Waterford. He just misses service in the war, marries, begets an heir, lives quietly up to the present year as a country gentleman in ancient Beresford Castle, attended by faithful retainers and servants. One morning this week, in the castle, a butler goes about his early morning duties.
Has my lord returned from the hunting, Bridget?
Aye, my lord's in the gun room putting up his rifles. A fine hunt he had, I'm after thinking. What with a blarney on his tongue.
Tis him, tis the finest lord in all Ireland. Bridget, a shot!
Patrick, tis me in my lord's house.
The gun room, quick!
I'm afraid, Patrick, don't go. It's too late, I know. He's dead. It's the curse of the Waterford.
And as John Charles, 7th Marquess of Waterford, dies this week of an accidental gunshot, Irish country folk wonder whether one-year-old Lord Darren Beresford, 8th Marquess, will inherit along with his father's earldom and baronies the 200-year-old Waterford curse. Time marches on. Concord, Massachusetts. At fashionable Middlesex Preparatory School one day this week, the slim, light-haired 14-year-old grandson of the founder of the Cudahy Packing Company, Robert Bob Cudahy, obeying a dread summons from his dormitory master, stands outside the master's half-open door.
Come in.
Did you want me, sir?
Cudahy, yes. Come in. Have a seat.
Thank you, sir.
Cudahy, you know the school regulations.
Regulations? Why, yes, sir.
Well, you know then that while gambling isn't expressly forbidden, it's one of those things that isn't done at Middlesex.
Yes, sir.
Very well. Then I won't need to stay anymore.
But I don't quite understand.
Now, Bob, don't make it difficult for me. I can't help knowing that you have been reading the Daily Running Horse and other racing form sheets, and I've overheard you and your friends discussing betting odds.
Oh, but, sir, it's not that I'm betting regularly. I mean, it just happens that, well, this is my own horse, Granite Sun.
You own a racehorse?
Yes, sir. A three-year-old.
Under your own name?
Yes, sir. You see, a man I know home owned a horse that had never won a race. So he said he'd give it to me for the price of the feed bill, $170.
Wait a minute. Slow up. Do you mean you have a racing stable of your own?
Oh, no, sir. Just one horse. I got it, and then Hugo, the chauffeur, and I made sort of a track out at an old polo field beyond Wentzia Club. I rode it, and he clocked it. And then I got Jack Peabody's trainer to take care of it. And this afternoon, he's entered in a race for three-year-olds at Lincoln Fields out in Chicago. Well, they're running right now, sir. I was just going to listen.
You have a bet on it?
Yes, sir. Oh, but it's not exactly a bet, sir. It's sentiment. You see, it's my own horse. And how would you feel if your owner didn't bet on you? I mean, if you were a horse.
I see your point. A matter of sentiment. But you're not betting big money.
Oh, no, sir. Only $6.
On the note, that is to win?
No, sir. Across the board in the machine. Is that all right?
Well, perhaps this one. When will you know whether it won?
Why, the race is being broadcast right now, sir. Oh, could we? Well, I mean, may I? Well, do you think we could turn on the radio?
Well, yes, I suppose you may.
Oh, thank you, sir. Of course, he's never done better than fifth and ninth start.
What's his name again?
Granite Sun. And some horse, sir. Oh, sir. Sir, listen.
They're off. Standing out where the favorites broke away from two-length lead at the post and is increasing it at every step. They're coming down fast. The horse on the outside is making a great rush. It's Wee-Wee. At the halfway, it's standing out by two lengths. Wee-Wee second. And a horse I can't see third.
That's my horse.
50-1 shot. He's coming up on Wee-Wee. He's passing it.
Oh, boy.
Kenyon's still leading the field by a length at the end of the home stretch. Now that other horse, Granite Sun, is making a race.
Come on, Granite Sun.
50-1 shot. He's coming up. Both jockeys are using the whip. They're neck and neck. It's still Kenyon by a neck, by a nose, by a whisker. No, sir, it's Granite Sun.
Oh, boy.
Granite Sun wins by a nose. Kenyon second. Wee-Wee third.
My horse won.
Congratulations, Bob. I almost felt as though it was my own horse.
Well, see, it was a great thrill for me, too, sir.
Yeah, you can put away your little winnings for spending money and consider yourself lucky.
Well, it's not such a little, sir. It must be a couple of $100 at 50-1.
Oh, on only $6?
Well, maybe it's even more, sir. I think the chauffeur and the cook were about the only other ones who would think of betting on him. They each had 50 cents on him. Gee, that doesn't exactly prove you always lose, does it?
Well, shall we say, Bob, it proves the value of sentiment.
When the betting odds on Granite Sun are announced, only 13 of 3,000 Lincoln Field bettors are found to have backed the winners. And 14-year-old Bob Cuddy's winnings on his $6 bet total $739.70. His horse is the longest shot of the year. Time marches on. The Bronx, New York.
Bruno Richard Hauptmann, you are indicted for extortion, suspected of kidnapping and murder.
I am innocent.
For 2 years, an aroused nation has sought the kidnapper and murderer of Charles Augustus Lindbergh, Jr. Then a fortnight ago, Bronx police arrest Bruno Richard Hauptmann, carpenter, one-time German machine gunner. Bronx County indicts him for the extortion of the $50,000 Lindbergh ransom. But still, the state of New Jersey and the nation wonder, does the evidence prove Hauptmann committed the kidnapping and murder?
The handwriting on the first ransom note, left on the windowsill of the baby's room the night of the kidnapping, has been identified in the criminal laboratories of the Department of Justice as your handwriting.
I do not know anything about it.
In your house was found a German-American dictionary, with the pages turned down, where appeared the most difficult words in that note found on the crib.
I am innocent.
The ladder used to enter the Lindbergh nursery was constructed from lumber taken from a lumber yard in which you once worked.
I do not know. I was never in Hopewell.
A keg of nails, exactly like those which held the ladder together, was found buried in the earth of your garage.
I know nothing about it.
It is believed that the person on that ladder wrenched his leg when it broke. You limped on a bad leg all the summer after the kidnapping.
It's as fair close strains I had.
Your footprints correspond to the imprints left beneath the baby's window that night.
I am innocent. I know nothing about that.
On the night of the kidnapping, did you meet a man named William C. Dennis on a road near Hopewell? And did you borrow from him a tire pump? That man claims you did, Bruno Hauptmann.
I never saw him.
A chisel found near the Lindbergh home bears the same trademark as the tools found in your garage.
I know nothing about it.
Bruno, Richard Hauptmann, in a trunk in your house was found a detailed roadmap of the country around Hopewell.
I know nothing about it.
Do you know, Bruno Hauptmann, that whoever received the ransom money identified himself by two special pins taken from the baby's crib and a child's blue sleeping suit? Do you know that $49,000 out of the $50,000 of ransom money have been traced to you?
The man Fish, who died in Germany, gave me the money. I am not guilty. I will be able to explain everything. I know nothing at all about the Lindbergh kidnapping. I am a decent man. I ask the world to withhold its judgment until the case is over.
Unbroken by 16 days of grueling examination, undaunted by circumstantial evidence which draws tighter and tighter around him its accusing web of fact, Bruno Richard Hauptmann stubbornly reiterates his innocence. As a now bewildered nation watches the law's battle against his armor of silence, the New York Law Journal pronounces,
before Hauptmann can be convicted of kidnapping and murder, many links in the chain of evidence against him are still to be forged. Lacking a confession or betrayal by an accomplice, the only crime concerning which proof is apparently complete is an offense with which he is not likely to be charged, that of hoarding gold.
Time marches on. Tonight, the editors of Time, the weekly news magazine, have selected, dramatized 8 scenes from the news of the week, from the 135 news stories in the current issue of Time. Time is the one and only complete record of this swift-changing civilization. Time fills the need of busy men and women for quick, accurate knowledge of developments in every field of activity in brief, readable form. 475,000 Americans have now discovered Time. It's the magazine with the red border and a portrait of the week's news headliner on its cover. You will find Time on sale at any newsstand. The new issue is out today. If you wish to have Time come to you regularly every week, simply call Western Union, ask them to enter your subscription for Time. They will deliver this week's issue tomorrow morning. For all the news of all the world, read Time. Time marches on. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.